Yes on Recall, Allison Collins, 78%! Yes on Recall, Gabriela Lopez, 74%! Olga Modiga, 71%!
Shiva Raj, one of the organizers of the San Francisco School Board recall, announcing last night's special election results. City residents overwhelmingly voted to recall three board members, including the board's president. Mayor London Breed supported the recall, and she will announce their replacements. She will appoint them herself. The recall was driven by parents frustrated with the board's priorities during the pandemic. And one of the biggest flashpoints was the decision a year ago to rename dozens of schools named after people the board said perpetuated white supremacy. And that included Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, even Senator Dianne Feinstein. Well, after widespread criticism that this was a sideshow to what the board should have been focused on, getting kids back in the classroom, the renaming plan was scrapped. Joining us to talk about all this is Marisa Lagos. She's a political reporter for KQED. Welcome back.
Hey, good to be here.
Wow, it sounds like a lot of passion, a lot of energy surrounding this recall. Why were these three targeted in particular? This is a 7-member board.
Yeah, it's sort of more of a procedural issue. They were elected in 2018, and under city rules, folks who had just been elected in the more recent elections were not actually, they couldn't be recalled. It was too soon, basically, under the recall statute. So backers of this said they would have targeted the entire board, but they had to focus on these three. And in some ways, it made sense, especially Allison Collins and Gabriela Lopez, because they were really at the forefront of a lot of the issues, some of which you brought up at the top, around sort of these controversies that went well beyond COVID closures.
Right. And these were the president and vice president of the board, those two. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were big leaders.
Okay, so let's talk about what was behind all this fury. I mentioned the renaming of the schools, and that got nationwide attention, was pilloried everywhere. Was that really the driving force?
You know, I don't think so. I think that this was one of those, you know, like a lot of things during the pandemic, it likely would not have happened without the pandemic, but it also was driven by, I think, some existing kind of wounds that existed in the city around questions. I mean, the renaming got a lot of attention. Fox News loved to hate on it. You know, it was the very San Francisco story. I think a bigger driving force beyond the fact that a lot of parents felt like, you know, this, what they saw as sort of performative progressive politics like that renaming were taking a front seat when schools were closed and it didn't even feel like there was an effort to get them reopened, were some deeper issues like tensions around the fact that this board also went ahead with a really controversial proposal to change the admissions process at the most elite high school in San Francisco. This is Lowell High School. And it was a merit-based admissions process. And they said that in order to increase, especially Black and Brown student access to Lowell, that they wanted to go to essentially a lottery system. And I think that really activated particularly the Asian American community, which, you know, had some issues before, but maybe didn't have the kind of critical mass when everybody joined together with all of these various critiques of the board.
Right. And so did that actually go through? Did they actually go through with this lottery admission process, or did they scrap that too?
You know, they did. And interestingly, even though this is such a flashpoint, it's actually shown some decent outcomes so far in terms of increasing diversity at the school. But, you know, Madeline, I think that a lot of times, sort of from the outside, people are focused on the nitty gritty of these things. Oh, was the school renaming process ridiculous? I think for folks who backed the recall at the beginning, especially, it was more the sort of sum total of its parts, the sense that this board was kind of dithering while Rome burned, while kids were at home, while parents were struggling. And while, you know, the gaps in achievement that have already existed in the city and state, you know, forever around, especially Black and Brown students, were not getting any better and in some cases getting worse.
Well, so There was some big money behind this recall, too, from people who might not necessarily have children in the school system in San Francisco, people in the tech world. And I guess we're used to that when it's concerning the charter school fight. There are a lot of tech people who support charter school initiatives here in Los Angeles who don't even live in the city, who live up in the Bay Area. But anyway, why were why was the tech community especially interested in this recall?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to differentiate between maybe the tech workers, the couple who launched this, which is, you know, a sort of more average couple, and the really big venture capitalists like David Sachs, Arthur Rock, who is a big charter school supporter. Arthur Rock, who put in almost $400,000 himself. We also saw some PACs raise a lot of money from wealthy investors. I mean, just to put it in context, Madeline, this election cost more than every school board race since 2016 combined. And all of that money, almost all of it, was on the yes side. Why? I mean, I think that, again, there's a combination of factors. I think some people had ties to the city, were really frustrated by what they were seeing. I think others saw a political opportunity. And this is what the no side really sort of leaned in on. They said, look, this is outside interests that are hoping to sort of separate, you know, divide the city and potentially push policies in the future that might be a little bit more friendly to, say, charter schools or other reforms. I'm not sure that that's going to happen. This is still a pretty democratic city. Certainly, I think the mayor's replacements will be maybe further to the quote-unquote center by San Francisco standards than the members who are recalled. But I'm not sure that this is kind of that sort of, you know, wave that we're seeing perhaps in other places within the state or even the nation.
Right, right. They're not debating critical race theory, as far as I understand it.
There's no critical race theory debate, although there is questions around sort of, you know, this question of equity. And I think that one thing the no side really says is that people objected to the process, and people have always objected to the process when we're trying to change conversations and systems.
Right. Well, let's talk about Mayor London Breed's role in this. As I said, she supported the recall. She'll choose the three replacements. What does it mean for her politically to be able to do that? And who is on her list?
Yeah, so we have not seen exactly. I know she's been talking to a lot of parents and advocates, and I have heard that she's interviewed a couple of people. This is certainly a big task for the mayor. These are people who are going to come in March. The school district has just a slew of really important, challenging issues ahead of it, including a huge budget deficit that has prompted the threat of a state takeover of the district. Our superintendent is leaving at the end of this school year, so they need to find a replacement for that. And so Breed's going to be watched really closely, and I think there's going to be questions. I mean, we should note one of the members who was recalled, she appointed. So it's not as if her hands are totally clean in this. And so I think there's a lot of pressure on her. And I think that, you know, whatever direction she goes in, there's going to be a lot more attention paid to her role moving forward that I think voters might hold her accountable if they don't see changes that they like at the school district.
Right. And in a bigger picture for her, she's also made some national news by, well, uttering a profanity, a mild profanity, at a news conference where she said she was cracking down on the lawlessness in the Tenderloin. And so how do voters see her and her, I guess, quote unquote, liberal credentials?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, it would obviously depend on who you ask. We have kind of two political factions in the city, the left progressives and the quote unquote moderates, but really who outside of city limits would be considered pretty lefty progressives as well. I think that there's people who have been very heartened by her rhetoric, both around the school board and crime challenges. I think others are watching sort of more warily, worried that maybe this is a lot of talk or that it could lead to sort of, you know, a backlash to a lot of the reforms around criminal justice and other things that have been really centered in San Francisco. So I do think that the mayor is going to have to tread carefully, but she does have a lot of political capital right now. And I think it's really up to her how she uses it. And, you know, if she's willing to reach out to folks who might disagree with her, which has not always been her style, honestly.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Marisa, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. Coming up, why an obscure 19th century law is getting a lot of attention these days explaining the Electoral Count Act and why it needs to be reformed, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In Washington, a big push to expand voting rights is on hold for now. A much smaller measure, though, is attracting more bipartisan support, and that is reforming a 19th century law called the Electoral Count Act. That law is supposed to tell Congress what to do if there are problems with the state's vote tallies after a presidential election. So it could allow Congress to decide the presidency, but the wording in the law is vague and confusing. But it is being used by former President Trump and his allies to try to dispute the 2020 and quite possibly the 2024 election. My next guest goes so far as to call the Electoral Count Act an unqualified disaster. Lawrence Douglas is a law professor at Amherst College, and he wrote about the Electoral Count Act and the role it could play in a constitutional crisis in his 2020 book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. And Lawrence Douglas joins me now. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be with you again.
Well, first of all, congratulations, I guess, on your foresight, because, of course, there was an election meltdown in 2020. But let's talk about what could happen in 2024. You call the Electoral Count Act an unqualified disaster, so you're really not mincing any words there. Why is it such a disaster?
The idea of the law is to tell Congress what to do should there arise a case in which the states can't really figure out who won their state, or in which a state, let's say, sends competing electoral certificates to Congress. And imagine that a state, you know, something like Georgia, sent one slate to Congress saying that Biden won the state, and then a competing slate saying that Trump had won. And the Electoral Count Act is meant to troubleshoot a situation like that. But the problem with the law is it doesn't troubleshoot it because it gives no clear guidance to Congress as to how it should act. And in fact, the language, it's expressed in something that I really could only describe as something like a semantic salad. When I first read the statute, when I was writing that book, I felt as if I was in the grips of some kind of precipitous neurological decline, because I really just couldn't make sense of what it was saying.
Well, can you give me an example of some of this word salad?
Absolutely. So this is a quotation from this Electoral Count Act. Remember, this is from 1887. It says, "No electoral vote or votes from any state which shall have been regularly given by electors whose appointment has been lawfully certified shall be rejected." Okay. That sounds sort of clear. We don't know what regularly given means, but if they are regularly given, Congress can't reject them. But continuing in the same sentence, but the two houses concurrently may reject the votes or votes when they agree that such vote or votes have not been so regularly given by electors whose appointment has been so certified. So it sounds then, yes, exactly. So if there's any meaning there, it sounds like even if they are properly certified, Congress can reject these votes. If they determine that they're not regularly given, the statute gives no definition whatsoever of regularly given. So if I were really just to kind of parse what it says Congress has to accept regularly given certificates unless it chooses not to.
Okay. So is that just because we don't understand 19th century verbiage, or was it written purposefully to be confusing?
I think the answer is no and no. You spend some time reading statutes and you'll be overwhelmed at the number which are just poorly drafted. And this is why even contemporaneous observers, shortly after the statute was passed in 1887, said, "What are we doing here? this really offers no guidance at all. It seems to say you have to accept these certificates unless you choose not to. And the circumstances of rejecting a certificate, as we saw on January 6th, the statute permits challenges to electoral certificates if only one member of each chamber raises an issue. So all you need is one senator and one member of the House to say, I don't like this electoral certificate that came from Georgia. Now, that doesn't mean it's rejected, but it does then require for the joint session to dissolve, each House to debate separately the challenge to the certificate, and then to decide whether it's a meritorious challenge or not.
All right. So even though there were these objections raised last time with the votes in Arizona, and there was some debate that followed, it was over pretty quickly, right? I mean, it wasn't that they dissolved the entire election.
That's right. Except the problem is, let's say you had Republicans, and we have to recognize that the Republican Party has become pretty dramatically radicalized over the last number of years. So if you have a situation in which you have a majority of Republicans in both the Senate and the House, and they support a challenge that has been brought to an electoral certificate, and that electoral certificate basically in a close election is decisive as to who carries the electoral college, then you could imagine that after this 1 hour debate, again, the statute says 1 hour, it could drag on for hours and hours and hours. But afterwards, you could imagine them getting together. And according to the statute, a simple majority is sufficient for then rejecting the electoral certificate. And I think that's the concern. The concern is that if you have a radicalized party that's willing to do the bidding of a would-be authoritarian, that's a recipe for basically overturning the will of the people.
Okay, so let's talk about the possibilities for reforming it. We have some bipartisan support for that. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski are working on a bill to reform the ECA. And Mitch McConnell has said he's open to it. What kinds of reforms do you think Congress should enact, or do you think they should get rid of it entirely?
Well, so a couple of the reforms seem to make, you know, some sense. So one proposal is to raise the threshold for a congressional challenge. So instead of just having one person from the House and one person from the Senate being sufficient for challenging a certificate, raise that to one third of each chamber. Sounds a good idea. And I guess another thing is to make clear that the vice president only has a ceremonial role in the counting of electoral certificates. I mean, this is another one of these problems that arises from the ECA that was exploited by Trump. At least it was the attempt was to exploit it. One of the things the Electoral Count Act says is that, and again, this language is a little bit more clear, except it's just ambiguous. So it's clear in that we can parse it, but it just doesn't tell us what to do. It says, if more than one return or paper purporting to be a return from a state shall have been received by the president of the Senate, namely the vice president, those votes and those only shall be counted which shall have been regularly given. Now, the thing about that is that last little business about only those regularly given votes shall be counted. It's in the passive voice. It doesn't say who does the counting. And so that's where you had these renegade lawyers, these rogue lawyers for the president, saying to Trump, well, maybe the vice president can. He's the one who shall decide which votes were regularly given. And so one of the proposals is to make sure that we now know that no, the vice president doesn't have any substantive role at all. It has to be Congress who makes that determination. And the vice president's role is exclusively ceremonial.
So those two are good ideas, you think?
Yeah, they're good ideas. But let me tell you one bad thing about focusing on the ECA and reforming the ECA. The bad thing is that one of the things that we've seen, one of the most disturbing developments I think we've seen over the last number of months, is the way that a number of states are trying to turn the certification process into this, you know, partisan exercise that's overseen by loyalists. And I think there are at least 8 Republicans who are currently running to serve as, you know, chief election officials in crucial swing states. And the problem with that, of course, is that if you have these loyalists installed, and by loyalists, we need to be clear, these are people who supported the big lie, the idea that Trump had his 2020 election stolen from him as a result of some vast Democratic conspiracy. So these officials, if they buy into that and they're able to subvert the will of the people in their respective swing states, then to the extent that the ECA now disempowers Congress from playing an active role in reviewing the certificates that come from the states, then in a sense, you've now just kind of shifted our worries away from Congress into the states. And it looks like the states are really a substantial source of worries about the integrity of our electoral system.
Wow. So absent any substantive voting rights legislation, which doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere, do you think that this is what is going to pass, that you'll have these shenanigans in these states where these Trump loyalists are being installed?
Well, I certainly worry. A lot of these things, these are elected officials, so they're not necessarily going to win, but they are running. And again, it's one of the pathologies of American democracy that you have these election officials as elected officials. That is, the people who are overseeing elections are themselves elected. I mean, they're not nonpartisans. And if they do get elected, then we could be in for a world of hurt. And then the process of challenging, it would be exclusively up to the courts to step in and say, no, you can't do this. And who knows if what the courts will do. And in fact, the courts could even say something like, they really could come back and say, this is again, one of the problems with our electoral system. They could come back and say, this is Congress's role, not ours. We're not in the business of deciding the outcome of elections. That's Congress's business.
Right, which is what they've done.
Yeah, exactly.
Lawrence Douglas, law professor at Amherst College. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure to be with you again.
Coming up, the supply chain problems have come for your Girl Scout cookies.
It does include Los Angeles. That's actually one of the places where I spoke to people who were experiencing some of the worst cookie shortages.
And avocados are also in short supply because the U.S. has banned Mexican avocados for now. We'll explain all next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and I have some terrible news. The ongoing supply chain issues and record levels of inflation have come for Girl Scout cookies. So your Thin Mints, your Tagalongs, even your Toastiers, whatever those are, they might be harder to come by this season. Rachel Wolf covers consumer trends for the Wall Street Journal. She herself is a lifelong Scout, and she's been writing about this. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. So how tragic is this?
It's terrible. It's the Samoas that really got me. Those are my favorites. And learning that there was a shortage of Samoas especially, I was like, oh, no.
Well, so how did you find out that there was a shortage? How did you discover this?
You know, I was curious what Girl Scouts have learned these past few years selling cookies in a pandemic. You know, they've been through so much these past few years. And so I sort of just stumbled onto the supply chain thing. I had joined all of these Facebook groups for Girl Scouts and was just kind of monitoring some of them. And I didn't even, I mean, obviously I identified that I was a reporter, but I was also like, lifelong Scouts are just allowed to be in these groups. I could stay even after I'm done reporting. And I was like, oh my God, like there is drama unfolding in the cookieverse because all of these cookie moms, all these troop leaders were posting that they could not get any Girl Scout cookies anywhere. So they were having to stop selling.
Any or just the Samoas? Are all of them experiencing shortages?
It is not every type of cookie, but it is many of them that are produced by one particular bakery. So there are two bakeries that supply Girl Scout cookies. It depends on your geographic area, which ones you have. So it's Little Brownie Bakers that is experiencing the production delays, and they service 75 out of the 111 geographic areas, or Girl Scouts call them councils. So it's a lot.
Oh my gosh, does that include Los Angeles?
It does.
Speaking for someone who cares right now.
It does include Los Angeles. That's actually one of the places where I spoke to people who were experiencing some of the worst cookie shortages. I'm sorry to report.
Oh no. Well, so what's the problem?
You know, the Girl Scouts themselves weren't completely sure. You don't want to speculate, but would imagine that it's a lot of the same supply chain labor shortage issues that are impacting the rest of the economy. It was very great to hear from the Girl Scouts themselves. I spoke to a 7-year-old named Cricket, whose dad was using it as a mini economic lesson, and was explaining to her supply and demand. And so she was then explaining to me, she was like, you know, there aren't any more cookies because the workers are getting sick and the bakers are getting sick and have to go home. And I was like, that is a excellent summary. What is likely going on? So Cricket said it best.
Which I guess is the point of the whole endeavor of selling cookies, is to learn about the economy or learn about, I don't know, supply and demand, how to be a salesperson, whatever.
It's part of it. I mean, really the whole point of cookie season is to raise money for the troops. All the money that's raised stays local, so it funds activities, Girl Scout dues for less privileged scouts. It funds charitable events, the different badges that scouts work on, but they do get cookie badges. So there's one called Cookie CEO, where they learn how to make their own business, or a budgeting badge asks kids to define and give examples of opportunity cost, which I don't know if I would be able to do. So, you know, they do aim to teach the kids a thing or two.
Well, now they can get a merit badge in supply chain management.
Exactly.
Well, when is this expected to be cleared up?
You know, they don't know. Some councils or geographic areas are extending cookie season, or thinking of extending it, to hopefully outlast, to wait on while they wait on more inventory, because since these cookie sales fund about 70% of troops' operating budgets, it's a really big deal if they can't sell as many cookies to get the funds that they need to operate. And so they're hoping that by waiting, there will be more inventory down the line.
Well, why doesn't the other bakery just step it up and supply to these places?
I'm sure that it's something that they're thinking about. I think it's the supply chain, like everything else. You know, they have a certain shipping route. They supply the same areas every year. And so, you know, getting trucks where they need to go. But I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing some ABC Bakers they have different names for the cookies. So instead of tagalongs, they're peanut butter patties. And so maybe you'll be seeing peanut butter patties instead of tagalongs in LA.
Oh, but it's the same cookie.
It's the same cookie.
Okay. Phew. Well, I just learned a lot about the economics of Girl Scout cookies and the etymology and all of it. So thank you.
I'm so glad. Yeah, it's something you get from being a Girl Scout.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Wolf from the Wall Street Journal. Well, another beloved food is in short supply right now, avocados. Last week, the United States temporarily banned imports from Mexico after an American produce inspector in Michoacan said he received a threatening phone call. No further details about that threat were made available, but 80% of our avocados come from Mexico. And here with more is Leslie Patton. She reports on food and restaurants for Bloomberg. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. Why was the threat serious enough to stop all avocado imports from Mexico?
Well, we don't know a lot of the details, but, you know, just talking to people, it seems like there's some sort of political things at play here that for the U.S. to shut down, to suspend, you know, imports of avocados from Mexico, where we get pretty much all of them. We get a little bit from here in the U.S. and other places, but this is pretty much the lifeblood of avocados is coming from Mexico for the U.S.
And the lifeblood for Michoacan, right? Don't most of the avocados come from that state?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Well, how big of a business is it in dollar amounts?
I'm actually not sure in total dollar amounts, but it's in the billions because, I mean, avocados, when you think about it, they are one of the most valuable commodities, single commodities that we have here in the U.S. They're more valuable than pretty much any other type of produce you can think about. And you can see it in the grocery store at the grocery level. I mean, when you're paying $2 each for an avocado, for example.
Oh, wow. Is that what they cost right now?
Well, I think we don't know yet. I know prices are starting to go up. Here in Chicago, they're up about 15% today. But you know, right now it's going to vary widely across the U.S. We don't know what they're costing per unit right now, but I think the headline is that prices are starting to go up. They probably will go up on the news of this.
Well, so the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said that there might have been political and economic interests at play in the U.S. decision to ban avocado imports. What was he referring to?
I think we're just not sure at this point on that. I cover more of the food and restaurant supply chain side and less so the political side, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay, sure. And so speaking of that, how is this going to trickle down into restaurants in the United States, restaurants that might be really reliant on avocados, like a Chipotle, for instance?
That's the thing. I mean, most of the avocados in the U.S., a large part of them go to restaurants. They go to food service. So that's a huge chunk of it. So you think of avocados, you mentioned it, you think of Chipotle. And of course, right now, them and grocery suppliers too, they're making sure they have enough. Chipotle has told me they have several weeks of supply. There's no shortage right now of guacamole at Chipotle. But, you know, they're working all angles they can, just like anyone else during this, looking to California. I know specifically Chipotle also sources from Peru. So that's, you know, a potential avenue for them to pursue if this thing doesn't get resolved in the next few days.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of California, how big a market is the avocado market here?
It's you know, well, it's about, you know, it makes up a lot of the supply where we don't have out of Mexico. So it's a pretty big market for the U.S., but then we're also getting some from South American countries, too.
Mm. So might this be a good thing then for California avocado farmers?
You know, it could be, but at the same time, avocados, as we all know, they don't last forever. We have this problem with fresh produce, with the supply chain. It's a just-in-time type of thing. It's not like you can quickly grow extra and ship them all over. I mean, it's just not possible. When you're thinking about produce and commodities, especially the fresh side, the demand is fairly inelastic, meaning you know, the amount we eat is pretty much the same. So year in and year out. And if you know, there is a hiccup in the supply, I think what that mostly means is we're going to see some spotty outages here and there. And a lot of it just depends on how long this ban, this suspension of imports lasts.
Okay. So meanwhile, where are all these avocados going to go if they're not going to go to the United States?
I mean, I think that's a great question because the U.S. is a huge recipient of avocados of Mexico. So it's unclear at this point. I'm not on the ground in Mexico, but I would imagine a lot of them, you know, could just be rotting.
Oh, wow. That is such a, that's so depressing.
I know, whether that's, you know, out in the field, at the actual farm level, or on a truck waiting at the border, or in some distribution warehouse. I mean, it's the sad reality that happened at the beginning of the pandemic too, when restaurants shut down. All of these big restaurant distributors had large amounts of fresh food, and a lot of that just went bad.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hope it's resolved soon. Leslie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Leslie Patton covers food and restaurants for Bloomberg. Coming up, comedian Al Madrigal is here. Remember him from The Daily Show? He has a new comic book out, and we'll talk to him about it next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A new comic book series is putting Latino characters in the lead. It's called Primos, and it follows three Mexican-American cousins of Mayan heritage who come together to, of course, save the world from evil. Set between Mexico and Los Angeles, it was created by the actor and comedian Al Madrigal. You may remember him as a correspondent for The Daily Show. Welcome back to Press Play, Al.
Hey, how are you? Yeah, it's been a long time.
It has been a long time. Okay, so why did you decide to make a comic book, of all things?
Well, it sort of all does start with The Daily Show, because when I first got out there, I did a podcast called Comic Book Live. And the other guy on the podcast, it takes out a picture on an iPad. He's scrolling through his iPad, and I see that there's a 9-year-old boy playing basketball. And I go, oh, you have a... My son loves basketball. They look around the same age. And then he takes off his jacket. He has a San Francisco shirt on. Oh, you're from San Francisco? I went to this high school. And then he said, oh, I went to that same high school. And we discovered very quickly that we had that and a ton of other weird stuff in common. Both half Mexicans, both with Korean wives. We had both had the exact same favorite restaurant in San Francisco, a city with, you know, hundreds of great restaurants. So we became instant friends, and that guy turned out to be the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics at the time, Axel Alonso, who's a fellow half-Mexican who went to my high school. So we started talking about the lack of any Latino, Latinx, Latine, Latina superheroes, and decided to do something about it. So there you go.
Oh my gosh. I mean, most people would just like vacation together or whatever, but you guys, you decided to just make a comic book together.
My friend Dave, he goes, I wouldn't even have commented on his kid's basketball photo.
So, so that started it all.
Yeah, that, exactly.
Well, are you a comic book aficionado to begin with?
I was aficionado, no. But, you know, when I did get to The Daily Show, I didn't make any of my sports teams when I was in high school, and I really wanted to. So I found myself at a comic book store picking up, whatever I could get into, and sort of, you know, comic book stores are weird. Either they're super welcoming, or there's, you know, the comic book nerd from The Simpsons criticizing your purchases. So, grabbed a book called West Coast Avengers, and then got to The Daily Show, and everybody was reading Walking Dead, Goon. When I met Axel, he turned me on to a bunch of books, and so sort of got back into it. And then again, doing research for this, really jumped back in. So,
okay, so tell us about the story. The main character is a kid named Ricky Pascal, and he's from Boyle Heights, and he's a bit of a, what, how would you describe him, like a party boy?
He's just like the CD student who, you know, is at some Euphoria. Do these parties even exist? Do Euphoria-style parties exist? I hope not. But he's at one of them. And he's drinking... And he just took drugs from some kid named Gilberto Suarez, and he has a couple of visions, pukes, and then realizes that he is late to take care of his brother and rushes home to find his, you know, long lost Mayan emperor uncle standing in his living room, and realizes that he's the most powerful sorcerer in the universe and he has a job to do. And it's now it's time for him to fulfill his potential, which no one thought he had any of. So
at least of all him.
No, he's always shunned responsibility, and now the weight of the world is on his shoulders. So he has to gather other descendants in this sort of protector line of his family and save the world. You know, it all comes back to like to DNA and ancestry. I was lucky enough to stumble upon this Mayan emperor, Kanik Janab Pakal, who ruled from 603 to 683, who's supposedly a descendant of the first mother. So I put this 17-year-old Boyle Heights kid in that line. And now he's, you know, got all this responsibility that, you know, he can't even barely take care of himself, let alone others.
So how much research did you do and how much did you learn about, I guess, your, well, one half of your heritage?
Yes. So I did a good amount, you know, and again, and I was lucky to stumble upon Kanik, and there was so much there. Everywhere I looked in terms of the weaponry, everything is just so amazing, so much to draw upon for the book, because they're all sort of gifted artifacts that awaken their power. And then lucky enough to team up with this incredible artist named Carlo Barberi, who does Deadpool. So he would draw some things that would inspire me to change the story a little bit. And it was very much a collaborative process. So lucky to have, you know, a bunch of great stuff to help us out.
That's so cool. So, I mean, you make a joke in your stand-up about how you don't really speak fluent Spanish. And so is this in a way to help you get back to that side of your past, your ancestry?
I mean, sure. I always felt connected. You know, Latinos are, you know, weird in that most groups don't have this. All Latinos are out to out Latino each other. So I always felt pretty connected to it. It's just other people wanting to say, hey, man, you're this, you're that, you're the, you know, I'm more Latino than you are. And so, you know, my dad just grew up at a funky time where he was, you know, graduated from high school in 1957. It was not as cool to be Latino as it is now. And not that it's super cool right now, because there's still people that vilify us. But he, you know, needed to assimilate. So that's how I ended up where I am. But in terms of, you know, me doing this for any reason, the main purpose I'm doing this is because it needs to be done. You see it with TV, 20% of the population and 5% of the characters in film and television. Comic books was worse. You know, it's just there's no Latino superheroes. So somebody had to.
Yeah. Why hasn't there been a Latino superhero, or a major one at least?
I think they were, I mean, it's the same thing with everything. It's like they, you know, all these characters are created in the late 50s, early 60s, and they were all, you know, white guys. And so I'm hoping that any Latina, Latino, Latinx kid, you know, that's 17 years old that stumbles into a comic book store and finds this, sees themselves on the page, which is be awesome. And it inspires them to do sort of the same thing and follow whatever creative path that they're on.
Well, speaking of, this is a comic book, but you're thinking maybe it could become a TV show, or it could become
No. I mean, this is, again, you know, the problem is with TV and the problems with everything, just all forms of media, you know, so it's a comic book, television show, reality show, whatever it is, you know, we're not there.
Yeah. You are creating a TV show, or you have created it. It's forthcoming on ABC called Gorillas. Right. And you're playing a guy who works for an oil company.
There we go. I'm sorry. I'm going to jump in. Dead at ABC, shopping it around elsewhere, but have Jaime Camille attached to it, who's incredibly popular from Jane the Virgin. Jane the Virgin creator Jenny Snyder Ehrman working with me on it. So just when you think, you know, you've put together the perfect package, you know, it's just not right for.
They killed
people.
It?
It is not going forward at ABC. They ordered a second script, but it's we're pursuing other options right now.
And how disappointing. It's, I mean, this goes to exactly what you're talking about.
Kind of. I mean, it's just the way it goes. It's, you know, unless you hit the right person at the right time, it's a little tricky. And even if you do that, so many different things have to fall in place. You know, again, TV development is really daunting. There's a lot of so many hoops to jump through. I always remember like doing a pilot and then, you know, you have that uncle or aunt who's like, when does that come out again? And it's like, it might not come out.
Ever.
And then if it did come out, no one could watch it. It could be dead after three episodes. So we really don't get our hopes up at all. You sort of just make them and cross your fingers. And so, yeah, it's just difficult to explain to people how this works. But there's 50 hoops to jump through. And, you know, each one is trickier than the one before it.
And that's generally the case in Hollywood, right, for every project. But I wonder what it's like trying to pitch a Latino-centered project if you feel like there are more hoops to go through or not, or you just don't know if it was canceled because of that or just other reasons.
I mean, pitching to the right type of Latino that can identify with your experience too. Like, you know, again, you know, I remember right when I got to Hollywood and we got a Latino executive on the phone from New York who had gone to Columbia and was Puerto Rican. We were pitching a very Mexican story. And the guy said, well, that's not my experience. So I really don't identify with this at all. And just again, like even when you have that, what you think is the right advocate in place, you know, it's hard when we can't even figure out what to call each other. Then you expect other people to know. It's we're in a tricky spot.
Are you talking about like Latina, Latinx, Latine? Is that what you're referring to?
Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine, Chicano, Chicana, Hispanic. Yeah, it's there's the eight things that people, you know, like and whatever anybody wants to be called is fine with me. I don't care.
What do you want to be called?
Just Latino, Latina, but whatever you want to call me is fine with me. Is yeah.
So how many of these comic books have you done?
I am just finishing the fourth book right now. So it's, I finally know how everything's going to wrap up. It's evolved over the course of writing it. It's super cool. I think it's a great story amongst comics. I think it's just got to be intriguing and good. And it doesn't matter who's in it. It could be a Korean story. It could be, you know, Japanese, whoever's in it just does it. I think this is just a quality comic book and a great story. And yes, it does draw on Maya culture, but and history. But again, I just hope it stands out and is comic book readers all enjoy it, not just, you know, Latino or Latina or Latinx comic book readers.
Well, Al, thanks for coming on the show. It's great talking with you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And good luck.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I need it.
Don't we all? Al Madrigal, actor, stand-up comedian, and creator of the brand new comic book series, Primos. Well, that does it for today on Press Play. Tomorrow, is it possible to change your personality? One journalist gave herself 3 months to become more outgoing and less neurotic. She even tried improv.
And I did not want to go to improv. I did not like the first few classes of improv that I did. I wrote that I wanted someone to knock me unconscious rather than do improv.
Was she able to change her personality? Well, find out tomorrow. In the meantime, go sign up for our podcast so you never miss an episode. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.